Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we continue our special series on the U.S. Constitution, highlighting a project launched by the Bill of Rights Institute titled Founders and the Constitution in Their Own Words, a two-volume collection of materials intended to add to our understanding of the remarkable stories and ideas of America's founders. This week we focus on slavery and the story of Charles Pinckney. But first, Dan Roberts offers us part two in his three-part A Moment in Time series on the constitutional issues addressed in the Webster-Hayne debate held in the U.S. Senate in 1830.
Starting out to debate high tariffs and the sale of cheap Western land, in January 1830, Senators Robert Young Hayne and Daniel Webster got sidetracked.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
The founders settled a number of important issues when they constructed the United States, but the Constitution of 1787 left untreated several key matters. One was the unresolved question of states' rights. What rights did the states retain? In 1830, high tariffs on imported goods were threatening the overseas sale of southern cotton. Dixie congressmen were hoping to find common cause with Westerners threatened by a proposed halt in the sale of cheap federal land. Senator Robert Young Hayne was a self-educated lawyer from the Lowcountry of South Carolina. He began the debate on Western land sales, but then broadened the discussion to the power of the federal government vis-a-vis the states. He was following the theory advanced by fellow South Carolinian, then Vice President John C. Calhoun. In 1828, Calhoun published South Carolina Exposition. In it, he explained the explosive idea of nullification. Calhoun and Hayne believed that a state could nullify or cancel within its boundaries any federal law it considered detrimental to its interests. At first reluctant to engage Hayne on the broader issue, Senator Daniel Webster of Massachusetts finally took it up. If nullification prevailed, then the Union was bound together with a rope of sand, rendering it almost useless. Hayne retorted with a full exposition of nullification, and Webster then rose, looked at the grizzled Calhoun presiding in the chair, and uttered perhaps the most stirring defense of the Union until Abraham Lincoln's debates with Stephen Douglas in the 1850s. Next time, Webster's reply at the University of Richmond. This is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, according to a recent BBC poll, British young people may not be any better informed than their American counterparts on their history. Fewer than half of those polled correctly identified Sir Francis Drake as a key figure in the famous British defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588, over half guessing it was J.R.R. Tolkien's wizard Gandalf, fictional sailor Horatio Hornblower, or Christopher Columbus. One-third did not know that William the Conqueror won the Battle of Hastings in 1066, while more than a fifth thought Britain had been conquered by the Germans, the Americans, or the Spanish at some point in history. But according to Simon Thurley, chief executive of English Heritage, an organization dedicated to the preservation of Britain's history, the blame for young people's lack of historical knowledge lies not only with the schools, which give students only a sketchy knowledge of history, he insisted, but also with Hollywood, whose films are guilty of a grotesque distortion of history. Both, he insists, are destroying Britain's national identity. This is Talking History. Among the topics covered in Founders and the Constitution in Their Own Words is slavery. With me this week to discuss slavery and the U.S. Constitution is Robert McDonald, professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point, and the author of the essay on slavery for the Bill of Rights Institute's publication. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks very much, Brian.
Good to have you. Your essay is more interesting than most I've recently read on slavery because it addresses the problem on really two different levels. First, as most would expect, you note that the existence of slavery deprived African Americans of independent lives and individual liberty for nearly 250 years. But you also suggest that slavery compromised the Republican dreams of white Americans. The first point's pretty clear, but maybe you better take a moment to explain the second.
Sure. I mean, the founders were very much concerned that the nation was half slave and half free. And a nation that's based on principles of liberty as well as presumptions of equality among the citizens, the notion that there would be free blacks, for example, who were perhaps released from slavery but then not allowed full citizenship struck them as very problematic. But at the same time, they weren't able to envision that former slaves would ever be able to be free and responsible citizens.
Okay, we're going to come back to that in a moment, but take us back, if you will, fill us in on the roots of slavery in the United States.
Sure. Well, the first slaves arrived in British-speaking North America in Jamestown, Virginia in 1619. A Dutch slave vessel, which was actually blown off course, landed there, and about 20 slaves got off the boat and were sold into slavery. But the primary form of labor in Virginia in the early years and in the other colonies was indentured servitude. Essentially, young English men and women would sign up for 4 to 7 years, and in exchange for passage across the Atlantic, they would come and work in the fields of the great tobacco planters of Virginia. This was a pretty good situation for the great tobacco planters at first, because the indentured servants who were promised tracts of land after their term of indenture usually didn't survive that period. The life expectancy was actually very short. Once they did, once they started to survive, get their own land, and compete economically with the great planters, you began in the 1660s and 1670s to see a shift towards slavery. Slavery was essentially a good business decision for the Virginians, as well as for people in South Carolina and the Caribbean and other parts of the future of the United States as well.
By 1776, though, we're not just talking about Virginia. Was slavery throughout all of the colonies? Were any, at that point, outlawing slavery?
The 13 original colonies all allowed slavery in 1776. And while the revolutionary movement did begin calls for gradual emancipation, and by some even for abolition, northern states retained slavery for quite a long time. In fact, Connecticut did not totally abolish slavery until 1848.
Okay, now this creates an interesting situation. You write about this in your essay. For the colonies that are declaring their independence from Great Britain at the same time that they're maintaining the institution of slavery. How did this sort of contradiction play out?
The colonies, of course, when they were rebelling against Britain, oftentimes phrased their objections to British imperial policies by describing them as attempts to enslave us. Essentially, the Americans saw slavery all around them, and they knew what it did. They knew what it could do. And when they saw the British taking their money without their consent, when they saw the British limiting where they could settle and their freedom of movement, when they saw the British station troops among them, they began to get the feeling that there was a systematic attempt by the British to take away their fundamental rights and their fundamental liberties and to, as they oftentimes very frequently said, enslave them.
But even given that, in the very founding document, if we could call it that, of the nation, the Declaration of Independence, we still couldn't rid ourselves of references to slaves.
That is correct. I mean, in the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, in his draft, tried to include among the many things that he blamed on King George III his allowance of the transatlantic slave trade. He said that it was one of his cruelties against humanity, one of his examples of treason against the hopes of the world. And yet the representatives at the Continental Congress from Georgia and from South Carolina harshly objected and pretty much implied that they would not sign the Declaration of Independence if that anti-slave trade platform were included.
So if they weren't willing to go along with the elimination of all references in the Declaration, we would expect that slavery would be referenced in the U.S. Constitution. So maybe we should move to that and tell us about how slavery was dealt with, referenced, even protected in the
Sure.
U.S. Constitution.
Well, of course, the Constitution was a document that was full of compromises, and there are a couple that stand out on the issue of slavery. The first attacks the question that the Declaration was not able to begin to resolve, that is, the issue of the slave trade. There's a provision in the Constitution that the federal government cannot do anything to eliminate or curtail the slave trade for 20 years. But once those 20 years expired in 1808, the president at the time, Thomas Jefferson, was able to push through Congress and sign into law a bill that did end the importation of Africans into America. So that was one piece of the puzzle in the Constitution. The second part revolved around the issue of representation. People in the North didn't want slaves to be counted among the people who would help determine how many congressmen and members of the Electoral College various states in the South should receive. There are far more slaves in the South than in the North. People in the South, on the other hand, wanted slaves to count as full members of their population so that they would have more representatives. They pointed out, for instance, that in the North, people who were disenfranchised, people, for instance, who didn't own enough land to vote, they were counted as part of the population as well. So finally, they settled on a compromise. Slaves would be counted as 3/5 of a person for purposes of representation.
Now, as we move into the 19th century, we get into a situation where the defense of slavery grows even more strident, and that defense has an economic basis, but it also has, as you indicate in your essay, some other interesting arguments against emancipation or the dismantling of this peculiar institution.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, tell us about, first of all, the economic defense.
Well, a big year in the history of slavery is 1793. That is the year that Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, which was a machine that essentially allowed for the separation of the sticky little seeds that are bundled in with a cotton bloom from that fiber. Because those seeds had to be removed beforehand through a great deal of labor, cotton wasn't a really efficient fiber to cultivate. Once the cotton gin, which separated out those seeds, was invented, however, cotton boomed, and it really became the lifeblood of the American South, indeed to the entire economy. It was our single largest export crop. It was something akin to cotton for America in the early 19th century is like oil is to the economy of Saudi Arabia today.
So that concern would also be shared in the North among textile mill owners and so on.
That's correct. I mean, the cotton boom really spurred the market revolution in which this cotton fiber that was so valued all around the world would oftentimes be shipped up to the North where the rivers tended to run faster, where a lot of capital was willing to invest in mills. And so the textile industry grew up in places like Massachusetts and Connecticut and elsewhere. We really were becoming, as a result of the cotton that slave labor made possible, a big part of the world's economy.
Okay, now a second qualification that you, or defense of the institution of slavery, has to do with the perception of the qualifications of a citizen. How did that work?
The founders really believed that in order to be a voter, you had to be independent. You had to be economically independent, and you had to be psychologically independent. One of the reasons that early on they did have land requirements for the franchise, for voting, is that they thought that if someone didn't own their own land, if someone couldn't provide for their own basic needs and the basic needs of their family, that they could be influenced by others, that they could be bought off, or as they would say, that they could be rendered corrupt. And so as a result, the idea of allowing former slaves, people who had absolutely no independence, people who were allowed to own no property, people who couldn't even hold property in their own bodies, to allow those people to somehow become citizens after all that conditioning and all that degradation really struck the founders as an impossible idea.
A third explanation you offered that I think is also important to remind us here is the religious or Christian justification for African American slavery. Summarize that for us.
Sure. I mean, during the 1830s in the North, a lot of people were inspired to call for an end to slavery. The Second Great Awakening led a number of preachers to point out that we are all equal in the eyes of God. And yet this provoked a counterreaction in the South, where a doctrine known as pro-slavery thought began to emerge. And there was a religious component of it. Essentially, it held that Africans in Africa were pagans. They had not found Jesus. They had not been Christianized. Their souls had not been saved. But here in America, they were not only cared for and civilized, but also Christianized. And so Southerners began to reason that slavery for Africans was in fact a good thing.
I think it's important here to remind our listeners that all three of these arguments were not necessarily located exclusively in the South, whether it's the economic defense, as we mentioned earlier, the qualifications as citizens, or the idea of the Christian justification. These were ideas that were shared really both north and south of the Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah, I think that's true. What you really begin to see happening, however, is during the market revolution, the positions of both sides begin to solidify as politicians begin to look west, as well as regular American citizens, and begin to try to understand whether the West is going to look more like the North or more like the South.
So the West is really a driving factor here.
It really is. I mean, when Thomas Jefferson signed into law the Louisiana Purchase, it solved many problems for America. The idea that there would be a powerful European presence on the North American continent was essentially wiped away. But it did open up this big question about how these lands would be settled, whether these lands would be places that would be home to slave labor or whether they would exclusively be reserved for free labor.
Now, this was dealt with fairly early on in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. So tell us a little bit about how that came about and what were the provisions included in that.
Well, certainly. I'll have to take us back 3 years before that, to 1784. Thomas Jefferson was a member of the Continental Congress at the time. He actually proposed that slavery should be banned west of the Appalachian Mountains, all the way from the Great Lakes down toward the Gulf of Mexico. So the future states of Alabama and Mississippi and Tennessee and Kentucky, all of those states would not have had slavery. Jefferson's proposal, his ordinance of 1784, was defeated by only one vote. And as a result, 3 years later, the Continental Congress was able to compromise on the Northwest Ordinance. It drew the line at the Ohio River. Anywhere north of the Ohio, slavery would be banned. Anywhere south of the Ohio, slavery would be allowed. And it leads to this really remarkable scene in Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, where he describes standing on the banks of the Ohio, and he looks north toward Ohio, and he sees industry and improvement and all these people working very hard. And he looks south into Kentucky, and he sees nothing but lethargy and sloth. He sees slaves not particularly caring about the work that they were forced to do, and he sees whites who were used to the slaves doing all of the work.
Does this really just kind of extend the references to slavery and the existence of slavery north? It's almost like taking the Mason-Dixon line, it seems to me, and extending it across the rest of the country, which many people have referenced in terms of the Missouri Compromise.
Absolutely.
Line.
The Missouri Compromise would extend that line further west. Then Texas would be admitted to the Union. Then you have the Compromise of 1850, which admits California as a free state, imposes the doctrine of popular sovereignty, which would allow voters to decide on whether or not there would be slavery in other emerging Western territories. So, yeah, I mean, it really delays the decision about slavery, and it really extends the divide between the North and the South all the way out to the Pacific Ocean.
Why couldn't the compromise last forever and avoid civil war?
I think it's really a question of political representation and distrust on both sides. Obviously, there were plenty of people in the North, and a small number, very small number in the South, who were absolutely committed to eradicating this form of human injustice. At the same time, it was the lifeline of the South. To ask Southerners in the 1800s to give up slavery would be like asking modern Americans to give up fossil fuels. It was absolutely necessary to their way of life as they knew it. And when you see Abraham Lincoln getting elected in 1860 with his name not even appearing on the ballot in 10 southern states, the South is convinced that it is now going to be frozen into a permanent minority, that Lincoln will not allow any more slave states to enter the Union, and that eventually the North will use its political power to eradicate slavery throughout the Union.
Okay, we only have a minute left, but you conclude your essay, I won't say by condemning, but issuing a certain amount of blame as far as the founders were concerned, suggesting that Americans paid dearly for their failure really to come to terms or to deal with the institution of slavery. I don't want to put words in your mouth, so let me ask you, how much responsibility do they bear for what followed?
I think it's certainly fair to say that they had a great opportunity to do something about slavery. In fairness to them, I think that we should say that they did. I mean, remember, it was Thomas Jefferson who eradicated the transatlantic slave trade. It was Congress, even before the Constitution, that prohibited the expansion of slavery north of the Ohio River. There were a number of northern states that instituted programs of gradual emancipation. In the South, even, states like Virginia, all the way up until the 1830s, flirted with the notion of instituting programs of gradual emancipation. So they really did try to do something. They really did understand the paradox. They really did want to live in a nation that, rather than being half slave and half free, was entirely free, with all of its citizens living at liberty. But I think the special understanding and appreciation of freedom that the founding generation had was lost on the groups that followed, especially when the North and the South got into a shouting match and developed their different ideologies, either justifying or condemning slavery. The time for compromise had really passed, and I think that we were on the road to a civil war that, as you know, resulted in the loss of 600,000 American lives.
And that's where we'll have to end it. So thank you, Robert, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Robert McDonald, professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point and the author of an essay on slavery for the Founders and the Constitution series. McDonald is currently working on a book to be titled Confounding Father, Thomas Jefferson and the Politics of Personality. This is Talking History. Founders in the Constitution, in their own words, includes 24 units, each dedicated to a specific founder. Our guest this week, Robert McDonald, prepared the following brief introduction to Charles Pinckney.
A native of Charleston, South Carolina, Charles Pinckney was the child of a wealthy family. He received a first-rate education and became an accomplished lawyer. Pinckney joined the South Carolina militia during the Revolution and fought the British at Savannah and Charleston. After the war, he became a member of the Confederation Congress and then a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. 29 years of age at the time of the convention, Pinckney was one of the youngest men there and was one of the most active participants in the proceedings, speaking more than 100 times. In his later years, those who knew him playfully referred to him as Constitution Charlie because he often boasted about his contributions at Philadelphia. Like most Americans of his time, in both the North and the South, Pinckney held what modern people would call racist views. Africans, he declared on one occasion, certainly must have been created with less intellectual power than the whites, and were most probably intended to serve them and be the instruments of their cultivation. Pinckney, a large slaveholder, was steadfast in his support of the institution of black slavery. At the Constitutional Convention, he defended the slave trade, a practice that even many of his fellow Southerners found revolting. In the end, however, believing the Constitution to be on the whole a worthy document, he was ready to compromise on the issue, agreeing to the clause that prohibited Congress's interference with the practice for 20 years. In the years following the convention, Pinckney continued to be active in state and national politics. As a member of the House of Representatives in 1819, he participated in the debates about the Western expansion of slavery. Pinckney opposed the Missouri Compromise, which proposed to ban slavery in the rest of the Louisiana Territory above the 3630 latitude. But the Missouri Compromise passed, the balance between slave and free states in the Union was preserved, and the resolution of the slavery question was left for another day. For the nation, it was the beginning of heightened sectional discord. For Charles Pinckney, it was the end of an era.
You've been listening to Robert McDonald, professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point. This is Talking History.
Thank you.
finally, for our site of the week, Talking History's Fiona Beattie reports on a new center where you can learn much more about slavery.
Here on the banks of the Ohio River in Cincinnati, the story of the struggle for freedom is told at the recently opened National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. Setting the stage for the exploration is a two-story slave pen, serving as a stark reminder of what it was like to be a slave. Sweet for Freedom, an orientation film, demonstrates the concepts of unfreedom and slavery. There's a special area designed for children that looks at escape and rescue and the Underground Railroad. And if you've pondered the perplexing issue of the existence of slavery in America, the land of the free, you may find some answers in the exhibit From Slavery to Freedom. And who were the heroes of freedom? An interactive exhibit introduces visitors to some of the key players throughout history, and in another area, the struggle today shows how the Underground Railroad has influenced subsequent freedom movements. It's all here, the history of women's rights, the tearing down of the Berlin Wall, the struggle for freedom worldwide, and the stories are told through a wide-angled lens, offering the opportunity to pause and reflect. For more information, go to www.freedomcenter.org.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you enjoyed the program. For more information on Founders and the Constitution in their own words, as well as a valuable collection of related materials, video clips, founding documents, lesson plans for teachers, and more, visit the Bill of Rights Institute website at www.billofrightsinstitute.org. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beattie, producer. Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. And finally, as always, we welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.